Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired in the Premier Radio Networks on Sunday, April 15th, Tax Day, 2012. This is episode 866. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Your time's valuable. Use Stamps.com like I do to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant I need it using my own computer and printer. To get my special offer, visit Stamps.com now. Click on the radio microphone and use the offer code TECHGUY. That's Stamps.com. Use my name, TECHGUY. Well, a good day to you, my friends. Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. And it's time to talk tech. Yes, computers, the internet, cell phones and camcorders, MP3 players and home theater, digital photography. Chris Marquardt, our photo guy, will be joining us next hour to talk about that. But you could talk about anything you wish at 888-ASK-LEO, 888-827-5536, toll free from anywhere in the U.S. of A. 888-ASK-LEO. Wow, what a week this was. Everybody, I think this is a tech story that everybody covered. Facebook buying an iPhone app called Instagram. Somebody tweeted me, gee, didn't they know they could get on the App Store for free? $1 billion they paid. $1 billion for a company. I think it's 12, 13 people. $1 billion for... It's an iPhone app. It's just recently, like 2 weeks ago, an Android app that lets you take pictures, apply filters, which is the hot thing right now, is applying filters. Somebody else tweeted, Facebook paid $1 billion for a program that ruins your pictures? I don't get it. Applies filters, it makes pictures look old or black and white or whatever, and then upload them to Facebook or other sites, or just have them on Instagram. Instagram itself does not really have a web page. You can tweet it and you get a link back to a single page, but you can't just go to Instagram.com and see my pictures. $1 billion. That's why I think it got all the attention, is just the $1 billion number. If it had been 999 million, it might not have gotten as much attention, but there's something about the billion with a B. Wow. That just blows people away. So the question everybody's asking are we in a bubble? Why did Facebook pay so much money for a company that was valued at half that a couple of months ago? Instagram had 30 million users, maybe 40 million with the Android crowd. But you got to think that every single one of those, with very few exceptions, is already a member of Facebook. So Facebook already knows more about those people than an Instagram than an app does. What's the deal? I wish I knew. I can't figure it out. And if you could, maybe you'd smart thing to do be start a company and sell it to Facebook for $1 billion. 15-month-old company. That's the other thing that's kind of amazing. I mean, this guy. Oh, and by the way, I'm told this is the way to do it. This company never made any money. In fact, it turns out, now get this, talk about crazy logic, 'tis better not to make money if you want to sell for $1 billion. The problem is, had they made $1 million last year, Instagram, then it would be very hard to pay 1,000 times earnings. that's really crazy. Having made no money was better than making even a penny. Is that wild? The advice, if you're going to do a startup, is don't make money if you plan to sell it to Google or Facebook or somebody else. That's better not to make any money, because as soon as you make money, then you have a value considerably lower, no doubt. You'd have to make, they'd have had to make $100 million last year to be even close to worth $1 billion or more. That's 10 times earnings. Turns out infinity times earnings is better. Wild. just wild. I don't understand it. Some were saying, I mean, there's a lot of speculation. Why would Mark Zuckerberg write a check for $1 billion for an iPhone app? Some just say, well, because he can. He can. He's got the money. He's got the money in very valuable Facebook stock. Remember, Facebook is going to go public soon. And this deal was not merely cash. It was cash and stock. So who knows? It could actually. In fact, this often happens when you get stock. In fact, almost guarantee when you get Facebook stock, they're getting more than $1 billion. It's $1 billion now. Ask them in a month when Facebook goes public. It could be worth five times that. Depends how much stock they got. Whoa. The founder of Instagram, Kevin Systrom, who I've met and talked to and is a very sweet guy, had a $400 million payday on Wednesday. I guess it was Monday. $400 million payday for a 15-month-old company. Right on, Kevin. You can't fault him for taking the money and whatever he did, run, buy a jet ski, I don't know. That's a good deal. They had quite a few investors, all of whom made out with bandits because they, you know, they invested small amounts of money for, say, 10% of the stock and got $100 million back. $100 million was allocated to the 12 or 13 employees. So every one of them is a millionaire now, probably several times over. That is amazing. I think some people were kind of upset by it. I'm just happy for them. If Zuck wants to spend his money that way, fine, whatever. He lives in a fairly modest home. He decided to, you know, instead of buying a fancy house on a hill, he decided to buy a software company. Why not? A lot of times when Facebook buys, in fact, up to now when Facebook buys a company, they're buying the people, not the company. In fact, they bought, I think it was a couple of years ago, maybe a year ago, a really great company that I was very fond of called Drop.io. Did you remember that, where you could create a... It was a really great way to share files. You could just do it on the fly. You could store it on the Dropio. Dropio, another example of a company that never charged any money, so I don't think they made any money. And as soon as Facebook bought it, boom, they killed it. It was gone, which I was actually very sad about. It was a very useful product. But what turns out what they wanted was its developer, the guy who started the company, Sam Lessin. Sam went on to design the timeline feature in Facebook. All right. Another company called FriendFeed that was kind of really struggling, not doing very well. Facebook bought it. Took one of its founders, is now the chief technology officer at Facebook. So what these are called acquires, hires. They're hiring somebody basically by acquiring their company. That's not, I don't think, what's happening with it's sort of what's happening with Instagram. I mean, I pray they don't shut it down because it is a great app. I use it all the time to share photos and stuff. I'm Chief Twit, by the way. you're trying to find me on Instagram. I'm not Leo Laporte. Usually I'm Leo Laporte. For some reason, I'm Chief Twit on Instagram. A lot of people on Instagram were very upset and said, I'm quitting. That's it. I'm out of here. Yeah, whatever. Is it a bubble? Is this a sign that we are, once again, irrationally exuberant, to use Alan Greenspan's phrase, from the last stock bubble? Are people overvaluing these apps? We certainly are in a booming app economy. It's estimated that nearly 500,000 jobs have been created by the app economy in just, 5 years since the iPhone shipped. A little less, because the iPhone didn't have apps when it first came out. It was only later. Was Facebook making a defensive move? Perhaps. Perhaps they didn't want Google to get it. Facebook is the number one photo sharing site. In fact, I think most people used Instagram also shared those photos right into Facebook. I did, certainly. Almost all my Instagram photos ended up on Facebook, too. Maybe they just wanted to keep it. Instagram was founded in 2010 by Stanford grads Kevin Systrom and Mike Krieger, multimillionaires. Until this week, they were privately funded, estimated to be worth, half a billion. Facebook pays $1 billion for it. Amazing. And everybody's wondering, what the heck? What the hey? Could have been defensive. Could have been fever, irrational exuberance. I don't know. Hey, speaking of fever, have you seen the pictures of the founder of Google Sergey Brin wearing the Google glasses. Whoa, we got to talk about that. Glasses that put the Google experience right in front of you as you walk around. We got to talk about that. 8888 Ask Leo. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
The same milkman. And his milk to be delivered.
That's not YMCA.
Milkman.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo, he's here to help you. Don't cry, Leo. We'll answer all your tech questions. We're starting with Dan, who is in Japan. Hello, Dan. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. Can you hear me?
I hear you great. Where in Japan?
Tokyo.
Oh, man. What do you do there?
I'm in the Air Force as an IT technician.
How awesome. That sounds like a pretty good post.
Oh, yeah. That's excellent. I love it out here.
Yeah, excellent. Well, thank you for your service to our country. Enjoy your travels. And what can I do for you? You're the IT guy.
Yeah, but I had a question, though, because it's new technology I'm not familiar with.
Yeah.
So glad if I can get some advice.
Well, if I can't help you, I think we probably have some smart guys in the chat and gals in the chat room who could help. What's the question?
I've got a WiMAX residential gateway that I use because the internet provider out here is kind of out in the sticks.
Uh-huh.
And the box only has two LAN ports. So I already previously owned an 802.11 router.
Right.
And I want to connect the two, but I'm kind of worrying about concerns with performance.
I think that should be all right. What you would do is make sure that the WiMAX router is in bridge mode. Well, one of them has to be in bridge mode. One of them gets to be your DHCP router, the router that configures the IP addresses of the machines that log into it, but not both. That's where you'd get a performance lag. It's interesting. So I guess you don't have WiMAX devices in the house, so you need a Wi-Fi. WiMAX is kind of a form of Wi-Fi, but you have to have a WiMAX compatible receiver, transceiver to use it.
It's more of a modem per se. It just makes.
Oh, I get it. So okay, now I understand. It's a receiver for WiMAX.
Yes.
I get it. It's not putting WiMAX out. Your internet service provider is a WiMAX service provider. I'm sorry. Now that I don't know why I was so silly. That makes perfect sense. Yeah, so it's got two Ethernet ports. I presume that both of them are available for hooking up a computer, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So here's what I would do. And I also presume the WiMAX router does do the DHCP.
Yes.
Probably be easiest to get a Wi-Fi access point and put it in what they call bridge mode.
Okay.
You can even get a Wi-Fi bridge, might save you a little bit of money. The idea being that it's saying just pass it along on the 2.4 and 5 gigahertz bands. Don't do anything, don't do any configuration stuff. Let the WiMAX modem do all the work. Is there a WAN port and a LAN port on that WiMAX modem?
There's two LAN ports.
They're both LAN.
I guess that's the switch portion of it.
Yeah. So Uncle Bic 2 says you can plug the WAN cable into one of the switch ports on the second router and turn off the DHCP on the second router without turning off the bridge mode. Just use the second router, in other words, as a switch.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Hey, thanks for your service to our country and to all of us. And great to hear from you in Japan. That's wonderful.
And just say thanks again. It was a long time ago. It was a call for help caller.
Oh, wow. So, you were probably a kid then.
Yeah, I was back in high school.
That's great. Oh, I tell you, I have been so fortunate over the years to be able to do this. And then I meet now a lot of people who say, yeah, I was a kid. I got into technology because I watched Tech TV, which we did in 98 to 2004. And I'm so grateful to have that relationship. So it's nice to meet you again, Dan. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
All right. Take care. I feel very, very fortunate to get to meet people like Dan. I do it, and so it's funny, you know. At first, when somebody says I grew up watching you, you go, "Oh my gosh!" And how old are you? But it really is a blessing. Let's go to line two. Jeff is calling from Burbank, California. Hi, Jeff. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. How are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you?
Doing great. Hey, I've been hearing a lot about this flashback Trojan virus for the Macs and how the Macs are getting all infected.
600,000 Macs at last count, 57% in the U.S.
Right. My question is, how are they getting infected?
Well, it happens two different ways. Originally, it was a kind of more traditional Trojan horse that required, you know, using what we call social engineering. They had to trick you, this was back in October, into installing it by pretending to be Flash or a Flash updater. And that's why it was called Flashback. Later, more recently, they've taken advantage of a flaw in Java. Now, Java is a programming language that actually does not come with Macintosh. Steve Jobs said it's a ball and chain. I don't want it on my Macs. Nevertheless, right. If you want to use Minecraft or there are websites that require Java, you'll need it. And here's the real problem. Java, which was created by Sun, now owned by Oracle, is updated by Oracle. Oracle fixed the bug that allowed, you know, it was a flaw. It was a exploit, a security flaw in Java that allowed a bad guy to access your machine without your knowledge or participation. That's really dangerous. That means you go to an infected website, and there were literally tens of millions of them out there. You go to an infected website, and it just kind of does its magic without you knowing behind the scenes if you have this buggy Java. So Windows users and people using other computers had the fix in February when Oracle put it out. Apple dragged its feet. In fact, and this is why there's so many Mac machines infected, just pushed out the fix this week. They've done it twice now. They pushed out a fix last Wednesday that fixed the exploit, and there's another one that went out in the last couple of days that also found and eliminated most variants of Flashback.
My question is, what sites do you have to go to in order for your Mac to get infected? Because obviously it's not just plugging your Mac in and turning it on.
No, you have to be online. I can't tell you what sites because there's very, very many of them. Here's how this stuff works. Once an exploit is discovered, once a hacker somewhere says, I have found a flaw in Java that allows me to, without participation from the computer's owner, put my own program on that computer. That's what a hacker needs to do. They need to put a program on your computer that runs. So he finds the hole. Then what he does is he creates a kit, a program that does it automatically. And then he distributes it, often selling it. There are online sites where you can buy kits with thousands of exploits that you would put on your website if you're a bad guy. A lot of adult sites have that kind of stuff. You know, not it's fly-by-night adult sites have that kind of stuff on them. Or, and this is even more common, you as a bad guy will find websites that are themselves hackable with a different hack and put your kit on that website. And then anybody who visits that website, and it could be a completely legitimate website that's just been hacked, then will get hacked. So if you, on a Macintosh, visit one of the many, 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 many thousands of sites that have been exploited this way, and you haven't patched your Java, you can get bit. If you own an Apple, make sure you run the software update right now and apply all updates. That's the fix. Hey, I'd like to talk a little bit about Stamps.com before we go any farther in this fine radio program. I've talked about Stamps.com before. Stamps.com brings the post office to you. Don't you love that idea? Whether you're running a business, working for home, or selling items through online sites, if you're an eBay buyer, for instance, I'm sorry, eBay seller, for instance, Amazon seller, for instance, you got to mail those packages, right? That might mean a trip to the post office. Postal rates are changing. That might mean a trip. Not with Stamps.com. Stamps.com lets you print official U.S. postage from your computer and your printer. You don't need a postage meter. You don't need special inks. You just need a regular computer, regular printer, Mac or PC, stamps.com. I want you to go to stamps.com right now, S-T-A-M-P-S. I don't have to spell that for you. You know how to spell that. I want you to go to stamps.com right now And now you'll see an $80 trial offer on the website. You don't have to worry about that. What you want is the $110 offer, and here's how you get it. You click that radio microphone. See that neat old Finn microphone in the upper right-hand corner? You click that. Radio listeners, I think it says. And it'll take. And then you enter the offer code TECHGUY. TECHGUY is the offer code. That'll take you to our special site and a $110 value, which includes, we've upped the postage just for you, my listeners, to $55 in postage coupons. You get a free digital scale. That's really cool because it's USB. You plug it in. Then you just pop the letter or package on the scale, and Stamps.com prints exactly the right postage. So it saves you money. You also get discounts you can't get at the post office. 2 billion letters and packages have been sent using Stamps.com. Shouldn't you be using Stamps.com? Go to Stamps.com, click the radio microphone in the upper right-hand corner, use the offer code TECHGUY. You'll get $55 free postage, a free digital scale, a $5 supply kit, a four-week trial. All you pay is shipping and handling. Stamps.com. We've been using it for years here at the Twit Brick House. And before that, I just used it myself because I just love the idea of printing my own postage. It just feels good. Just feels good. So extreme. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. 888-827-5536. That's my phone number. If you don't remember that, or you want show notes, or you want to see the chat room, or watch our video, or listen to audio from previous shows, etc., 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 the website is techguylabs.com. Techguylabs.com. And that's really all you need to remember. Everything I talk about, all the links I mention, they're all put there. Rich is on the line, our next caller from Montgomery, Alabama. Hello, Rich. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. Great to talk to you again. Got Thank a question you. Regarding YouTube and copyright. These guys are driving me crazy over at YouTube.
Yeah, they drive me crazy, too. What's happening?
Well, we, a group of guys and I, run a podcast where we promote independent artists. We review their music and promote it, and we post excerpts of our podcast up on YouTube.
Yeah.
With these independent artists' music. The artists post original music to our site. We review that music, and then we post that to YouTube with their permission, of course. And YouTube, we're constantly getting copyright notices from YouTube from these crazy companies out there that are apparently throwing sheets into the wind to match.
That's what I think. I think it's spam, and I get the same thing from Brazilian companies and stuff that have nothing to do with any of the content in any of my shows.
Exactly. We're getting exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. Now, my question is, obviously, we dispute all of these.
Good.
And we get the artist involved as well.
Good.
And the question is there anybody at YouTube we can talk to about maybe trying to fix this? Maybe we can band together and get this stuff fixed where they're not doing this in this crazy, idiotic, automated way.
If you find somebody, will you let me know?
Oh,
here's,
my God,
so
I would, yeah.
Here's how it works. Here's what's going on. I just want to explain it to people. So YouTube is protected by the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and a particular clause in the DMCA, which says that anybody who puts content on the Internet is protected. It's called the Safe Harbor Provision. Mm-hmm. It's protected if they provide a mechanism for takedown. That means if a copyright holder spies their material under somebody else's name, illegally used, they file a takedown request to YouTube or any other site that has content. This is most websites. Tumblr would apply. Pinterest would apply. They file, and everybody does this, and they file a takedown request. And then YouTube, there's a whole process at this point. YouTube will take it down. We'll let you know they took it down and give you a chance to appeal. If you appeal, this is how YouTube does it, automatically put it back. If the copyright holder then contact the copyright holder, if the copyright holder asserts again, no, this is copyright material, now it gets sticky. YouTube will take it down for 10 days, file notice with you. You have the right to appeal, but it becomes a much more complicated process. You have to prove that you own all the content. The burden is on you, by the way. That's part of the problem. The burden is on the person posting the video on YouTube. Now, YouTube has gotten even more aggressive about this because they're really terrified about getting it sued. They really, and I kind of understand this, they and most web content creators, and I include myself, want to be treated. I'm a publisher. I publish content. So I'm responsible for my own content. But YouTube wants to be treated as a carrier, kind of like the phone company. If the phone company were responsible for copyright or other illegal acts on the phone, it wouldn't work so well. They'd have to monitor every call, right? So the phone company is treated as what's called a common carrier. They're not responsible as long as they take reasonable precautions. In the case of YouTube, as long as they provide a takedown process. But YouTube's gone a little farther. They have, and this is where I think you and I, Rich, both are getting bit, an automatic system. An automatic fingerprinting system that looks at every video, because 24 hours of video are uploaded every minute on YouTube. It's impossible for a human to do this. So this automated system looks for, just like an antivirus, looks for fingerprints of viruses. This automated system looks for fingerprints of content that copyright holders have said, hey, that's ours. So NBC, for instance, will submit fingerprints. CBS will submit fingerprints. And the YouTube automated system will search for those fingerprints. If found, the automated takedown happens, you have an appeal, and blah, blah, blah. The problem, Rich, I'm with you. The problem on this, I think, is that rogue companies are submitting fingerprints, and YouTube isn't checking them, and you and I are getting flagged for copyright violations that don't occur. And here's why a company would want to do that. YouTube gives the company a couple of choices. They give them the choice of taking the video down, but they also give them the choice of placing ads on the video. So let's say I'm Brazilian copyright thief number one. I submit fingerprints to YouTube saying I own, and it could be stuff you don't own. And apparently YouTube doesn't care. YouTube flags that stuff, and you say, yeah, oh, that is my stuff. Put a commercial on it and send me the money. So you'll notice what tends to happen in these cases is not that the video gets pulled down, but they apply commercials to your video that's not yours. Somebody's making money off your stuff.
That's what's killing us is YouTube had just recently given us the opportunity to monetize our YouTube channel. And, you know, when this kind of thing happens, it's just like, you know, and the same thing happening to you. It's the taking money out of your pocket.
And YouTube will send you to copyright school. I love this. If they make you watch a video, a really bad video with a pirate in it, so that you understand copyright. You know what, YouTube? We understand copyright. You don't understand copyright. You're the ones who are screwing with us because you're allowing these bad guys, these spammers, to manipulate your system. And I'm really, I'm really upset about it. And I'm with you. And if you figure out the problem with YouTube, the problem with Google in general, is it's not run by humans. It's run by Python scripts. It's run by computers. And go ahead and try to talk to somebody at YouTube. Good luck, because I've never been able to find anybody. They must know this is going on. But remember, when those ads are placed on there, Brazilian hacker organization number one gets money, but so does YouTube. So they're not that incented. They make money.
Yeah. All right, Leo, I appreciate it. Thank you.
I'm with you,
much,
Rich. I am so glad you called. It gave me a chance to go off on YouTube. They listen. The show is broadcast in Silicon Valley on News Talk 910 in San Francisco. They're listening. I hope their faces are beet red right now. I hope they're ashamed of themselves. I wish there was something we could do about it. Cost me money because every time that they do this, A, my ads are overwritten by their ads. They're covered up. And when they do a takedown, they take me off the air. Now, by the way, I have something that you don't have as a defense. It's called fair use because all my shows are news shows. This is a news show. So I'm allowed in the process of doing news to play excerpts of copyrighted material. That's called fair use as an explanation. So if I played, for instance, right now, the YouTube copyright education video, even though YouTube owns the copyright to that, I can play it as an excerpt because we're covering it as news. Doesn't mean YouTube won't pull it down. And every time they pull down one of my things, they actually played a video a couple of weeks ago on one of my news shows. YouTube had a great video. I thought it was wonderful, demonstrating how autonomous cars could help a blind driver drive. We played the video. YouTube pulled my show off of YouTube, costing me significant amounts of money. We appealed it. We got it back. But most of the downloads, as everybody knows, occur in the first 24 hours. I'd lost them. Thanks, YouTube. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. It's Happy Tree Friends.
Everybody's really been looking forward to the new video from Lumpy and the Lumpettes.
Oh, this is the...
Even Lumpy.
Listen to this. This is a YouTube copyright video. If you get dinged a number of times on YouTube
Russell's
for copyright
a huge
violation,
fan.
They make you...
He can't wait to tell all his friends about it.
They make you watch this horrible video.
Hey, Russell. You didn't create that video. You just copied someone else's content.
Uploading someone else's content without permission could get you into a lot of trouble. It may be copyright infringement.
That's enough of that. Leo Laporte, oy. Makes me want to foe up. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. They make you watch that, by the way. I had to watch that. And I think, I can't remember, I think I had to take a quiz after I watched that. I've never been more insulted in my life. Jay in New York, Leo, and I have friends. I have friends at Google. I mean, that's just the thing. I know many of these guys. I don't understand it. Jay in New York, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo, how are you?
I am well.
Long-time listener.
Thank you.
I'll start off my tale by quoting Mort Saul, the old comedian, who said, just because you stop being paranoid doesn't mean they're still not after you.
I love Mort Saul.
So it was great stuff.
That's
so here's
true.
My situation. My accountant sent me my tax return unprotected,
oh,
no
Lord.
Password on it.
Oh, Lord. Through the email?
Okay. Email.
Oh, yeah.
From AOL, no less. And I'm worried about, I know it goes across multiple hops, and there could be malware, I guess, residing on any of those. And, of course, the subject line was tax return or whatever.
Oh, and well, the worst thing is that anything that a bad guy would need for identity theft is in there. Your social, your address, your date of birth, all the things that they would need for identity theft. So you need to edumacate that that accountant.
Oh, I asked him five times. I said, be sure it's at least there's a password on it. They assured me, and somehow it didn't. I said there should have been an error message on your internal software that generated it. So here's what I've done, and then I'm looking for suggestions from you in terms of anything more to do. I alerted, first of all, I deleted from my inbox and the trash his email. I had him do it on his end from the send side and the trash, so at least it wouldn't be still sitting out there. Secondly, I alerted my banks, brokers, and credit cards. I'm wondering about now my level of vulnerability, and I'm thinking about signing up for one of these identity theft companies.
You could. I use LifeLock because I'm a public figure, and I just figure, I don't remember how much it costs. It's not cheap, but it's a lot cheaper than fighting if somebody steals my identity. So
right.
To me, it's worth it. Here's what I would do. I think you've done everything appropriately. And you're probably, let's hope you're being paranoid that nobody noticed it and it just went through the internets without anybody stealing your stuff. But your good idea to check, and everybody should do this anyway, every month check your credit card statements. If there is identity theft, usually it will not show up there because what they'll do is create new credit cards in your name. So what you really need to do is go to the three reporting credit bureaus and check, and you could do this once a year for free. Do not go to freecreditreport.com. It's not free.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a lie, as I found out. It's like $20 a month, freecreditreport.com. Go to annualcreditreport.com. That's run by the three reporting agencies. And check your credit report. And then you want to do it more than once because, well, what will happen is if a new credit card has been created, it will show up on that credit report. So you want to do that. There's one more step that I really like, and that's calling the three credit reporting agencies, Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion,
right,
and putting a fraud alert on those accounts. Now, here's what will happen when that happens. It has a limited period of time. It used to be 6 months. I think it's shorter now. But for some period of time, they will not be allowed to give anybody your credit information without your explicit permission. They'll have to call you and get permission. What that means is nobody can use the information they gleaned from stealing your tax return to get a credit card. And that's what you want to watch out for, somebody using that information and getting credit on your name, because it'll go on your credit score, you know, and they don't plan to pay off the credit card. They plan to ring it up as high as they can and then walk away because it's in your name, not theirs. So the best thing to do is look at your three credit reports from Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion. Check it. And then if you want extra protection or you're really kind of worried, you can request a fraud alert placed on there.
Okay. I'm worried also about them possibly draining my account.
Generally speaking, you know, they didn't get the bank account information, right?
No, unfortunately, he also miscoded, and so my bank codes, my account.
So the transit codes were on there, but he did it wrong, thank goodness.
He did it wrong in a sense, right. I wanted the money applied to next year, and he put it into my bank, so he included the bank account code and the routing code, all of that. On the tax return.
Well, you've obviously fired this guy. You're not going to use him next April 15th.
Oh, absolutely. And they got to do amended return to add it all in.
Oh, this is terrible. I mean, this guy is obviously a goofball.
He's a tax attorney. Get that.
Oh, he should know better. And anybody who's listening, you know, you cannot use... Email is not secure. You cannot send email... with private information in it, because as every server it goes through, it's visible to. That happened. The good news is, you know, there's millions and billions and billions of emails every day. The chances are nothing happened. But if you want to be prudent, check those credit reports. You could do that for free. There is even a credit. There's one step harder than a credit fraud alert, which is a credit freeze, which says nobody can issue credit without your permission at all. Not only can they not do a credit report, they can't do anything. And that's a little bit of a pain. I've used this in the past. I've had fraud alerts on my account and then went to buy a car, and the guy said, I can't sell you a car. I can't get a credit report. And then you have to call him and say, let the guy have a credit report. I think that's a minor inconvenience to prevent the
identity theft. Situation.
Once identity theft, you want to do everything you can to prevent it, because it is horrible if it happens.
That's what I've been worried ever since it started.
It's probably all right, but boy, is that stupid. That is so stupid. Please don't. Oh, man. Protect, you know, your social is your social security number is really, really important to protect. And it used to be sometimes people would use it as a password, or like a passcode. It's protect it like it's gold. Because if somebody has your name and your social security number, They're really most of the way towards stealing your identity. If they had your date of birth and your address, they're done. And of course, they have all of that on Jay. Annualcreditreport.com. The FTC also has something similar. You know, it's funny. I'll talk about LifeLock in a little bit. I use LifeLock, and I think it's a good company. There was a concerted campaign against them for a long time by the credit reporting agencies. They don't like them. And they wanted to put them out of business. So I did a lot of investigation, and there was a lot of negative to read, but it turns out it was all generated by Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. Unfortunately, LifeLock's been prevented from putting those fraud alerts on your account anymore, and that was a very effective thing. They would keep those on. They no longer can do that. So all they can really do is kind of monitor. So they're less effective. I think it's worth it. Just one more way to kind of protect myself. Hey, you want to talk about protecting yourself? Let's talk about backing things up. We're going to get back to the phones in just a second. Mike is calling from Sylmar, California. He's having trouble starting up on Windows 7. Mike, Sylmar, California. I only got a minute, Mike, but maybe we could take you through the news. What's your problem?
The problem is here. I have my brother's computer here, and I was going to upgrade it from Windows Vista Ultimate to Windows 7. Okay, so should be a pretty easy thing. The computer's not that old.
I'll help you do the upgrade. Yeah, it should be easy, shouldn't it? We'll talk about it when we come back. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte, the tech guy. It's time to talk about computers and the internet and cell phones and camcorders and MP3 players and home theater. 8888 Ask Leo. Coming up, Chris Marquardt. I think he might be traveling. Chris Marquardt, our photo guy, usually stops by this hour. But I haven't heard from him yet, so maybe he's traveling. But we'll talk about digital photography, too. I don't need Chris. I'm a photography nut. Actually, I should mention, I'm going to be out of town. I'm going to Norway for a photography festival in a couple of weeks. So on the 28th and 29th of this month, our home theater guy, Scott Wilkinson, will be back. He'll do two shows filling in for me. He does such a great job. So if you're interested in home theater, you've got questions, hold them for Scott. He won't be here next weekend, but the weekend after doing the Tech Guy show. Meanwhile, I'm here right now. The phone number, 888-827-5536. That's toll-free from anywhere in the U.S. If you forget that number, go to our website. We've got it there and everything you need to know at techguylabs.com. So we finished up last hour with Mike from Sylmar. He's got a Vista machine. He wants to install Windows 7 on it. What's going wrong, Mike?
It goes up to a point, and then at the first time it actually tells you it has to reboot.
Yeah.
During installation, it goes to the main screen. It says where Windows is starting, and that's where it stops. Those little dancing flags don't.
It never
pop.
Goes past that, huh?
Never goes past that. And I've tried so many ways and gone to so many forums.
Here's what I would suggest, and it's actually my recommended way to upgrade. Don't. Format the drive and install Windows 7 clean. I know that's a pain because if you install in place, you preserve all your apps, all your data is still there, blah, blah, blah. But this was not a good way to install the upgrade to Windows 7. It failed for a lot of people. What I would do is back up your data, collect all your application disks. Better yet, most of the applications you can probably download updated versions anyway. Do you have a Windows 7 install disk?
That's what I'm working with.
Yeah.
And what I don't understand is when I use the old Vista disk, it's basically no problems. Why would there be a problem with the Windows 7?
Because you're upgrading from one version, Windows Vista, to another, Windows 7.
I always thought they were like almost the same.
Well, I know they're almost the same, but there are differences. And to be honest, I really don't like upgrading operating systems in place. It's almost always better to install a fresh version of Windows 7. You're showing us that fact. I mean, I don't know what to tell you, Mike. There's no magic. I don't know how to get around that stalled install. You've done everything you said you could do. I would say the next thing to do is to wipe the drive and start over with Windows 7. Judd in Los Angeles, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. Got a question for you. I'm formerly mainly a Mac user, and I've since switched over to Windows just because of a lot of the apps that I've needed to use. And I'm just kind of uncertain about where the direction Apple's going with Mac Pro line. Anyway, I'd like to get some OS X Finder functionality into Windows 7, if it's possible. The three things I miss most are colored labels on the file names, spring-loaded folders, and being able to see folder sizes when you're looking at, you know, like the files in the window.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I would miss all those things. I don't know. I don't really know how to get them on Windows, though.
Is there maybe a third-party, like Windows Explorer or something like that?
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, it would be.
Let me ask. I don't know of one. Let me ask the chat room. Is there any way that this guy... Colored folders you can do, right? But spring-loaded folders, that's when you drag something to a folder, it pops open and you can see what's inside it. And you can drill down if you want. I wonder, does Stardock have anything like that? I mean, the problem is... I mean, what I would do is I'd stick with the Mac and run Windows and virtualization if there's Windows programs you need.
Yeah, the trouble is, you know, it's just, I'm so uncertain. It came down, basically, when I got a new machine, it came down to cost because, you know, it's $2,500.
Yeah.
The base level Mac Pro, and they haven't been updated in a couple of years. So I'm just kind of unsure where Apple's going.
Yeah. I guess it's really going to be a question of just trying to, you know, customize Explorer as much as you can. Somebody in the chat room saying that Windows Explorer does support spring-loaded folders.
Oh, it does?
Yeah, but I don't know how to do that. I don't use Windows very often. I'll tell you that the company that's been best known for customizing Windows looks like they've kind of gotten into the game business more than anything else is Stardock, stardock.com.
Okay.
And they do really let you customize Windows. They have a lot of interesting user interface modifications. I've used them a lot in the past, but I always ended up taking them off because I felt like it's slowing things down and,
okay,
and stuff like that. But take a look at it. They have trial offers you can at least see. They have a number of programs that completely customize the way Windows works. Stardock, S-T-A-R-D-O-C-K. .com.
Okay.
And I think that somebody in the chat room is saying that Stardock actually worked on some of the themes in Windows 7. I wouldn't be surprised. They really are good at making Windows more appealing. And then I'm going to put, Brian says in our chat room, has just given us a link, which I'm going to put in the show notes. Actually, James, would you do that from tested.com? How to steal. Oh, this is Jamie and Adam's site. This is the guys from Mythbusters. Tested.com. They have an article, How to Steal Mac OS's Best Features for Windows. That's a good idea. A couple of years old. It's from July 2010. But that's interesting. So it has a number of third-party apps you can add that will give you some of the features. Spring-loaded folders. Oh, boy. There are here's a paragraph you won't like. There are still a few Mac OS X features you just can't get in Windows. The feature I want most is spring-loaded folders. Some Windows Explorer replacements like Magellan have this feature, but it only works in an Explorer window and not on your desktop. So Magellan then sounds like a program to take a look at. Stardock, we just mentioned them, used to offer a Spring Folders program for Windows XP and Windows 95 as part of its Object Desktop suite, but they discontinued it. Oh, Lord. You know, these are minor things. This is what my friend Merlin Mann would call a first world problem. These are minor differences between the way Windows operates and the way Macintosh operates. Most of us just get used to. Strengths in my chat room. By the way, great place to go if you want to. I mean, these people are so smart. And there's 1,000 people in there right now who just can answer any question. Strength says clicking on the folders button shows them in a sidebar on Windows XP, and they work as spring-loaded. I don't know if that works in Windows 7 or not. It's possible, as Kappen points out, that Microsoft is worried about Apple suing them. Windows Shake is something you should look at. That's a new feature that started appearing in Vista, and I like that a lot. There's also a Lifehacker article. We'll put this in the show notes, too, at techguylabs.com, how to get Windows best features on OS 10 for those of you who want to go in the other direction. We'll put links in the show notes for both of those. I am sorry, Judd. You have to use a PC. I think probably the best thing to do is just speak the dialect of the operating system you're using. Just bite the bullet. There are better, you know, I have to say, it goes both ways. As that Lifehacker article shows you, there are people using Macs who wish they had Windows features and vice versa, like the libraries. The smart libraries in Vista and 7 are great. And, you know, this is, there's no perfect operating system. As Uber Willow says in our chat room, when in Rome, do as Bill Gates would do. 8888 Ask Leo. More of your calls coming right after this. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Know in the end, I'll always be there.
It's true, I'm the tech guy. I'll always be here.
And when you're
in doubt, I will fix it for you.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 88 88 Ask Leo. Let's go to Scott in Tahoe. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Leo, how you doing?
I'm wonderful. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I was down there last week, so you'll remember who you're talking to.
Oh, gee, Scott. Good to see you again.
Yeah, thanks. So my question is, like I said, I'm heading back to having to use satellite.
And oh, you mentioned this. So Scott has a vacation home, and so you're in your more full-time home. You have regular internet, but out in the boonies there, where is it, Minnesota?
Yep.
You don't you have to go to the Hughes satellite, which is not very fast, also really slow uploads.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm capped at 200 megabytes.
And that's the big problem, 200 megabytes a month?
A day.
Oh, a day. Okay.
A day. So, but streaming, even radio, is, you know, I get maybe 3 hours and I'll hit that cap or something. So.
Well, if you want to download this show, for instance, that's right about 200 megabytes. If you want the high def version of some of our shows, it's over a gigabyte. You couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Take it 5 days to download it. I shouldn't laugh. That's terrible.
Yeah. Well, I'm stuck with it for a while, but I do have the middle of the night.
Right.
They allow unlimited downloads. Ah. 1 to 6 in the morning Eastern time.
Perfect. Perfect.
So I'm wondering about maybe a download manager that I can tell to download the tech guy, etc.
Schedule your downloads.
Yeah.
You know, download managers, back when we were all on dial-up, were very popular. Everybody used download managers to, because for one thing, that the kids picked up the phone in the middle of a download, the whole thing gets disconnected. So a download manager would be able to resume the download. That was nice. Scheduling downloads even better. I haven't used a download manager in ages, not since broadband internet became a commonplace, because most of the things I download, I can download pretty quickly. So let me ask the chat room, because these guys would know better than I what a good modern download manager would be. In particular, all you really need is the ability to schedule it, although it wouldn't be a bad thing to maybe have it also monitor how much you've downloaded so far, right?
Right, exactly. And scheduling, I think, is the big thing there.
Yeah. J Downloader, according to David Bix, who's been very helpful in our chat room, he says, do opt out, though, of the bundled toolbar. A lot of times that happens with these programs. In fact, it happened in the old days, too, that they would try to install a bunch of other stuff. So J Downloader is still there. Is Get Right still around? Boy, I used that for years. Looks like people think that J Downloader or Star Downloader. But J Downloader is free. It's jdownloader.org. And it seems to be the consensus of the chat room. And as you know, G. Scott, because you're a regular in our chat room, these guys are never wrong. They're always right.
That's for sure.
And they're smarter than average.
Yeah, I figured between you and them, we'd get her nailed.
Yeah,
the
chat room's the one. Now, Get Right is still out there. You can try before you buy. It's $20. Although, in some ways, I kind of like the idea of paying for it, because then I think you're less likely to bundle in other stuff trying to make some money, make a buck. Let's see.
Right,
Get Right.
$5 a day if I have to buy a token for more bandwidth. Yeah.
Is that how they do
it?
Yeah, that's that fair use thing that they
yeah.
Accelerate downloads by getting files from several servers at once. That you don't want. Recover downloads interrupted for any reason. That might be useful. No more lost files. Easy to use, powerful, flexible. Doesn't mention scheduling, but you could at least download and try before you buy. I would guess that anything works.
You know, I Googled it and I came up with, you know, just a chunk of them. So I thought I could.
Well, there's the two that the chat room like: J Downloader and Get Right. And you know, I'm glad you asked, because I bet you there's about 100 people listening who said, "Oh, that's good." Download them all. An add-on for Firefox, Cleric points out. Exceed is a new kind of satellite internet that Bob Heil, our Ham Nation host, has been recommending. That gives you 5 gigabytes a month. That's a little less than 200 megabytes a day, though. So I'm not sure that's really what you want. Satellite, yeah. Satellite is, unfortunately, right now, the only way a lot of people in very rural areas can get internet, high-speed internet. I hope that changes. It's one of the things the FCC is trying to do, is to make high-speed internet available to all. I think of it very much in the same way that rural electrification happened in the 20s in the U.S. It's for the same reason. You know, the electric companies didn't want to string wires to areas where the density of population was five people every square mile. It just wasn't, you know, wasn't good business. In the same way, internet service providers, you know, they're not going to put internet access, they're not going to put cable television or put a network operations center near enough to you to make DSL effective if there's five people per square mile. Only the government could do that. You know, they're the only ones who have a larger vested interest than merely having a profitable business. It's just not profitable. So in the 20s, we had the rural electrification happen with things like the Tennessee Valley Authority that brought power to rural areas that would not have had it otherwise. And I think the FCC in its broadband plan is also considering something like that. I think it'd have to be wireless to be economical, something like WiMAX. But I think it is doable. I really do. And you have my deepest sympathy. Scott, appreciate the call. Teresa, Long Beach, California. You're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. Got a question about it's photography related.
All right.
My monitor on my laptop matching up colors with my printer. And is that what you use a calibration program for?
It is, yes. And it is a little tricky because the monitor creates color differently than the printer does.
Yes.
Your monitor is what we call emissive. Yeah, well, it's emissive. It's light coming out of the monitor hitting your eyes, whereas the printer is reflected light, isn't it? Just like reading a book. So it's never completely matchable, but this is something professional photographers need to do all the time. You want to see an image with your eyes, capture it with your camera, adjust it on the screen, and print it out so that it matches the original image, or at least matches what you want your image to look like. The reds are red, the blues are blue.
I know, and I have a Samsung laptop, and the colors are just wonderful.
That's good. Remember, you're not going to get that vivid color from a reflective surface. It's never going to look as bright and vivid as a emissive screen is. The most of the time, the built-in color profiles are sufficient. But if you want to spend some money and time, you can get some devices. The pros do it. For the screen, you want a spectrophotometer, something like the Spyder, S-P-Y-D-E-R, I think. Let me check, make sure I'm right on that. Spyder spectrophotometer is fairly inexpensive, and it goes right on the screen and will measure colors and then allow you to create a color profile for that screen that's accurate. And then you need a... I think it's photoretinometer, I think is what they're called, for the printer, does the same thing. It's a little tricky, but it can be done. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Singing Code Monkey. And that's because we were talking about different ways to measure the colors on your screen. I mentioned the Spyder, S-P-Y-D-E-R, the Spyder 4 Pro, which is $170. Somebody said, "Oh, the Color Monkey, M-U-N-K-I. That's they like that." The Pantone folks, who are responsible for color in general, also sell their own monitor and printer calibrators, like the Huey Pro, which is $99. But now these are spectrophotometers; these measure emissive color. So you use these, like the Color Monkey or the Huey, but actually both are from Pantone. You use these to adjust your screen. Truthfully, I don't think you need these. All modern screens come with profiles. As long as you're using the right profile in your monitor settings, you're probably pretty right on. But you could create your own. That's what they do, and they run you through some software. You create your own color profile based on the screen. But that's only half of it, isn't it? Because now you need a colorimeter to measure, to look at the prints and calibrate the printer. In most cases, I think the truth is that the printer profiles and the monitor profiles that come with the devices are sufficient. But pros often do it themselves. They don't trust it. And I guess if you're not getting the results you want, that's probably useful. I guess the first thing I would say is make sure you're using the color profiles for both the printer and monitor that match the printer and monitor. That's a good start. Reith in Silverdale, Washington's next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Reith.
Hey, Leo. Thanks for taking my call. It's great to be talking to you.
Nice to talk to you.
Well, I have started a digital conversion project for VHS tapes, old home movies, that I no longer want to finish.
I don't blame you.
I found a website. It's called memoryhub.com, memory, H-U-B as in boy. And they seem pretty good. And actually, I found them because I found their old site, which was Stash Space, S-T-A-S-H space.com. And I'm not looking for authored DVDs. I'm looking for just getting the files.
You want the files, and you keep them on your hard drive, and if you wanted to burn DVDs, you could. And that's actually smart because the DVDs are stored in MPEG-2 format, which is a little lower quality than the H.264 you could get if you were just going to put it on your hard drive.
Right.
Yeah, and you're right. I think a lot of people call me and say, I got a bunch of VHS tapes, and I've got a converter, and I'm going to convert them. And, boy, you're right. It's a pain, isn't it?
Yeah, and, well, actually, thanks to you, I have a Synology disk station now, which is
excellent.
I really want to use to put those out to my friends and family and other methods as well.
So you want to actually offer them online. It'll be like your own iTunes. It'll be Reith's iTunes. That's a good idea. I like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Another company that does this I would look at is Scan Cafe. Scan Cafe is one of the biggest in the country. They do a lot of these. They say they charge $14.99 per VHS tape. I don't know what the other one is.
That's a lot.
It's expensive because, they got to sit there and run through the tape in real time, right?
Yeah, well, you know, I was doing it myself. I had a Sony Handycam that was FireWire with a digital pass-through, and I was plugging my VCR into that and then using the digital pass-through and using Dolby Elements Premiere 8 to capture the video. But about 5 or 6 tapes in, I started eating tapes, and these tapes are just something I can't risk losing. So
yeah. Now, it says Memory Hub is at $8.99 a tape. Is that right?
Yeah, that's why I was pretty impressed. And their prices seem to be a lot lower. And they got the Better Business Bureau logo at the bottom. They seem pretty legit.
Anybody in the chat room ever use? I haven't used them. Anybody in the chat room ever use Memory Hub, or anybody listening? Let us know. I've never converted tapes. I did my slides, and I used a kind of a local company in Providence, Rhode Island. My sister had the slides, so she just went over there, and they did a great job. I was very pleased. I guess what you could do, is take a tape you don't care very much about. This is what Louis J. is suggesting in the chat room, and send them one and see how it does. See how it does. For $9, what's the big deal? And see if they do a good job, if you like the quality, if it looks good. Remember, VHS tapes are not super high quality. You already know this. You're not going to get DVD quality out of a VHS tape. But at least, and this is the advantage, you're preserving them. Those tapes will not last forever.
Yeah.
As you've discovered, some of them aren't playing right.
Yeah, and actually, because my grandma was a smoker for so many years, a lot of the tapes have got a nice green haze over all.
Oh, Lord, yeah.
I'm trying to rescue as much as I can right now. Because my grandpa actually passed away when I was very young, and I don't even remember him. And I'm trying to get these tapes back so I can try and build some memories of this guy who I'm named after. And, you know,
isn't
I don't have
great.
Any memories of. So.
Isn't that great? Well, I certainly think it's a worthwhile project. I'm glad you're doing it. And I do think that if there are difficulties with the tape, sometimes sending it to a service bureau is better. They know they have techniques.
Yeah.
And they might be able to do a better job than you do. What is the part of the problem is that think about how VHS tapes, any mechanical tape or audio tapes, it's all basically the same. They have a Mylar backing, a plastic backing, and then magnetic material is laid on top of it. And the magnetic material, that's how it's recorded. There's a magnetic head that arranges the magnetic material to record data. There are a couple of problems with this, of course. A magnet's going to ruin this tape. It can get re-magnetized. But also, after some time, usually 10 years to 20 years, the Mylar backing starts to separate from the magnetic material. The tapes start flaking off. And then, if that goes down the road far enough, you absolutely cannot recover them. So your tapes are aging right now. Even if they're stored perfectly, they will, within a decade or two, go bad, and you'll never be able to get them. Plus, you know, there's mechanical moving parts that can go bad in the tape. VHS tape players aren't exactly in plentiful supply. Nobody's making new ones. So it's probably a good idea not to delay on converting it. It is not cheap, as you see. We got a range from $8.99 to $14.99. If anybody has experiences, if you've converted a VHS tape collection with one of these services or any other service, call me. Let me know or visit our chat room. You'll find links to the chat room and the phone number at techguylabs.com. 8888 Ask Leo. Somebody said, is it a good idea to put your tapes on YouTube after you've digitized them for archival? You know, I wouldn't say don't do it. YouTube lowers the quality. They compress it heavily. And, you know, certainly YouTube's going to be around for a decade or two. But who knows? 100 years from now, will YouTube still be around? I doubt it. So it's not a bad idea to do that. I wouldn't rely on any single way of storing these. I would keep a hard drive, wrap it in plastic, put it somewhere, or non-static plastic, put it somewhere. I would store it in the cloud. I would store it on YouTube and Vimeo and everywhere you could think of. This is actually an issue that we're going to all face, which is that, you know, if you put something on zip disks a few years ago, do you have a zip disk player anymore? These formats are changing faster than ever and becoming obsolete more quickly than ever. With pictures, I think probably the best thing to do, believe it or not, is print them. Put them on paper. If you put them on acid-free paper, they'll last a lot longer than any other digital storage format. Keep the digital versions, but put them on paper. 8888 Ask Leo. Kappen in the chat room says, hey, I've got a zip drive if you need one. No, I don't need one. Thank you, though. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888-ASK-LEO is the phone number. Derek in Moreno Valley, California. You're next. Hi, Derek. Hello. Did I press the button? I guess I did. Hi, Derek.
Hey, how you doing, Leo?
I am well. How are you?
This is good. I'm doing good as well. I have a question for you.
Yes.
On music.
Okay.
It has to do with this being on, say, the Droid. I know what you're going to tell me, but I'll say it anyway just for the sake of telling you. I got an iPad, I got an iPod, and I've also got a Mac, but I've got a Droid phone. So is there a killer app for the Droid that I can connect to my Music Match music up on iTunes? And then I heard you mention before about, like, maybe having redundancy, you know, for a backup of your music. Other than, say, iTunes Music Match, is there a way that, is there a second way to back up my music?
Yes. Let me tell you what to do, because I'm in the same boat as you. iPad, iPhone, Mac, Galaxy Note. I use a lot of Android devices. So I do use iTunes, and I do pay for iTunes Match, $25 a year, because on my iDevices, you know, I don't have to put any music on it. I can literally just stream down any song that I want to hear from my 40,000 song collection, because I've uploaded it all, whatever. It's not that big. 20,000 song collection.
Exactly.
Because I've uploaded it all. Now, you can't exactly do that on Android, but you can at least sync up your Android phone to your iTunes collection, your iTunes playlists. You could do it by connecting it or through the air with something called Double Twist, which is free and excellent, and I highly recommend it.
Double Twist.
DoubleTwist.com. Now, what Double Twist has a free portion, which lets you sync just like iTunes. You connect your phone to the computer. It has all the iTunes playlists. It'll sync it up just like iTunes does, except it works on an Android phone. But if you pay a couple of bucks for Double Twist Air Sync, it'll do it through the Wi-Fi as well. So as soon as you get home, your phone goes on the Wi-Fi network, it starts syncing up your music. It does not support iTunes Match. There's no way on Android to get those iTunes Match songs. Apple doesn't let you do that.
Okay.
But you could use Google Music or something like that. The truth, if you want that streaming, I use that as well. Google Music will allow you to upload 25,000 songs for free. It takes a while to do it. They don't do the same things Match does. Apple paid license fees to the music industry that lets them just check and see, oh, what song, and then you don't have to upload it. It just says, yeah, I have that. With Google Music, you have to upload everything, you know, because they didn't pay the license fees. But the truth is, it works pretty similarly. So between Google Music, Double Twist, iTunes Match, and iTunes, I think you got it covered. That's how I do it. And I do the Match for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's backup, right? I don't have to worry about losing any of my songs once I've matched them. And you don't have to keep paying that $25. Just do it once. I also used it to replace all the copy-protected songs because I don't want any more DRM songs. That's one thing that Double Twist won't do. If it's a copy-protected song with the iTunes copy protection, you can't put it on your Android phone. It won't play. So one of the first things you want to do is pay the $25 for iTunes Match. Match all your songs. Then I would take your library off the Mac, put it on a hard drive somewhere, store it for backup, but delete all the files from your Mac, and then have Match download fresh copies of it. They'll be unprotected. They'll be high-quality AAC. They'll be really good. It kind of refreshes your library with copy protection-free music in high quality, usually higher quality than you got before. Then you can use Double Twist to put it on your Android phone. So there is hope, Derek. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. It's great. Peter, Connecticut, you're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Oh, I got to push the button. Thank you, Peter.
Hey, Leo, how are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
Very good. Big fan over here. I'm looking for I know it's probably hard, but an ad-free solution or something that I can have a little bit more control over the ads that play over, say, Ustream or service like it. My dad has church, and we like to stream the services live.
But Ustream will stick ads for poker and stuff like that in there.
Yeah, beer and women and lingerie.
Stuff
and
that's stuff totally like that. Inappropriate during a church service.
Right.
Yeah. I don't blame you. That's really a problem. I think there's a way to turn off the ads on Ustream, isn't there? Let me ask the chat room.
They're expensive.
Yeah, you have to pay for it. I see.
Yes.
So you're looking for another service provider?
Probably. Yeah, I've heard about YouTube Live, but they are
That's not going to do it. You have to get into that program. I can't even get into that program.
I see.
So there's a couple of Justin TV has a pro account that has no ads. That might be less expensive. I don't know what the prices are. Livestream apparently has a ad-free version. They really, all three of them ought to offer for churches, for nonprofits.
I know.
Ought to offer an ad-free version. It would be a nice pro bono thing to do.
Or ratings on their ads. I mean, general rated ads.
Wouldn't that be a good idea?
Yes.
Yeah. So, you can pay to remove ads, but as you say, Ustream. How much does Ustream want?
Oh, it's a lot.
The pro broadcasting.
200, 100 a month. Or
that's crazy.
Like that.
Yeah.
It's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we only have like 5 or 6 viewers at a time, and we like the feature where it saves the recordings. They give you like 10 gigabytes, and it's good for like 2 years. Where the services go like once a week or something like that.
It's very frustrating because it's not costing Ustream very much to provide the stream for those 5 people. They should do it for free.
And I understand. I don't mind if they show, Kibbles and Bits ads or whatever, But
right, but you don't want to see lingerie ads during the sermon.
Right.
That's really not appropriate.
Yeah. The one we had a complaint about was women mud wrestling.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. That's just not appropriate. I don't, that's a really interesting question. There are ads that are, ad stopper. I'm looking at the chat room, and that's why I pause here. There are programs you can run that will take ads out. I don't really recommend.
But the end user would have to do that.
Right, and that's not going to be the solution, right? I would just look at Justin.TV and live stream and see. Now, Justin.TV has completely inappropriate ads for poker and stuff, too. So what you want to do. Oh, wait a minute. Look at this. Thank you, Mac.
Ooh.
Mac Sest. Yep. Ustream.TV/user/nonprofit orgs. Here I was beating up on Ustream saying they ought to offer nonprofits something without ads. They do.
Where is it?
Ustream.TV/user/nonprofit orgs. Well, what? Now, wait a minute. Now, this is. Okay, now this isn't the answer that I was hoping for. It was a link in the chat room. It is somebody who is a nonprofit doing a Ustream channel to help nonprofits.
Oh,
but you might ask them. They might have an answer for you. That's just a user. I was hoping, and I, you know what? I'll contact our contacts at Ustream. They really should have a program for nonprofits without ads. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, a good day to you, Leo Laporte here, the tech guy, and it's time to talk tech. Computers, internet, cell phones, home theater, photography, all that jazz. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number. If you have a question or a comment, suggestion, love to hear from you. 8888 Ask Leo. Well, thanks to the chat room. They did come up with a good solution for our last caller. He streams church sermons to a handful of people who can't get to church and want to watch. But the problem is they've been using services that unfortunately overlay ads and sometimes highly inappropriate ads for things like mud wrestling on these church services. That's not nice. Here's the good news. YouTube does, in fact, offer live streaming for nonprofits. There's a YouTube nonprofit program. And as of just last month, they opened up live streaming. So if you're a church or a nonprofit of any kind, you should apply for the nonprofit program, youtube.com/nonprofits, youtube.com/nonprofits. And then you can use YouTube's live streaming capability, which, of course, is very good, to do ad-free streaming. Yay! It says the YouTube nonprofit program is currently open to registered organizations in the U.S., U.K., Australia, and Canada. It offers free benefits like donate buttons, overlays, custom thumbnail selection, and channel branding, and, of course, ad-free live streaming. Yay! YouTube.com/nonprofits. So there we go. Thank you, chat room, for that great solution. That's the way to do it. Now, let's go to Don in Kentucky. Don, you're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello, Leo.
Hey, Don.
How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Been listening to you since Tech TV and used a bunch of your information. I feel like I owe you a steak dinner if you ever come to Kentucky.
Well, thank you. I'll take it. I appreciate it. Where in Kentucky are you?
Near Mammoth Cave.
Oh, wow. I'd love to see that.
Well, you come, and you'll be my guest.
Awesome. Thank you, Don.
Free Wi-Fi.
Do you work at Mammoth Cave?
No, sir, but I know people that do.
Ah, you have friends there.
Yes, sir.
Awesome. Well, when I was at Tech TV, we made a couple of trips to Louisville and had a great time, and I love the area, so I'd love to come back out. Now, what can I do to help you, Don?
My grandfather is 92 years old, very intelligent, but can't hear.
Right.
My daughter just got a new iPad 3, is what I call it. She said it's just iPad, but iPad 3 that has Siri that types out. When you talk, it types out things. And I was wondering if there was a way that we could talk and have it type out to a monitor that he can see, like an Apple TV, an iPad, an iPod. Do you know of anything that does that?
Well, that's a good idea. So the idea would be that since he can't hear you, of course, you could always write something on a notepad, but what you'd like to do is use the iPad to take down what you're saying and display in big letters for you.
Just for him, yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, certainly the iPad itself could do that. You could open a notepad and make it a big font size. I think the notes in iPad, the Notes program itself would do that, but there are other programs, third-party programs, let you put a big font size. Now, here's how it's going to have to work, and it might not be convenient. You'll have to have the iPad and click in the note page to say, I want to type something, and then when the keyboard comes up, you press the microphone and you start speaking. Now, you have to be, it's pretty good dictation, but it's not perfect. I find that I have to enunciate. There's certain words it tends to get wrong. It might be good enough for Grandpa to understand anyway, but you have to have access to the iPad, and then I guess you could hand it to him. Your other option, and this is what you asked, is, well, is there some way that that you could be holding that iPad and it could be displayed on a screen? And an Apple TV would do that using AirPlay for sure. You can the new iPad, you can anything that's on the screen can be AirPlayed out to an Apple TV, the new Apple TV. But that's okay. Going to add $100.
Is it app or does it automatically just do that?
You don't need an app. No, everything does it now. It used to be that you had to have a compatible app. But now AirPlay is in throughout the iPad.
Okay, so AirPlay to an Apple TV would do that for me.
You bet.
Okay, that's what I need to know.
You bet. Hey, thank you. That's a very innovative way to use an iPad. I like it. And I do find that a lot of seniors, I'd include my mom. I don't know if she, you don't mind if I call you a senior, do you, Mom? Hey, I'm a senior now, too. I just got the senior discount at our grocery store across the street. So I'm a senior, too. So a lot of us like the iPad because it's easy to use. It's secure, has most of the features we want. Mom has a desktop Macintosh, a laptop Macintosh, and an iPad. And I think she uses the iPad almost exclusively. I think it's a really good choice for people who just don't need to do a lot of typing. And now with this new dictation, it's kind of interesting. I've been using it a lot on both the iPhone and the iPad. And now when I have to type an email, I feel I put out. It's like, well, that's too much work. I just want to talk. They're going to have to put this on the desktop. That's for sure. John in Redlands, California. You're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo.
Hey, John.
Can you hear me okay?
I hear you great. What can I do for you?
Okay, here's the deal. I've got two Macs. I've got a MacBook, an older one. It's not that old. It's probably a couple years old. It's got Snow Leopard. And I've got a late 06 iMac that has Tiger. And what I want to do, if it's possible, is make an image of this system on the newer system and put it on the iMac because I want to upgrade the laptop to Lion, but I want a newer operating system on the iMac because it's, you know, Tiger doesn't get updated anymore.
Right.
Is that possible?
Sure. A program that you'd want to use is called Super Duper.
Super Duper, okay.
It's free from superduper.com. It will make a disk image for you.
So not use the regular disk image utility that's on the system already? It doesn't.
You could use that, but it'll be easier if you use Super Duper. Here's the steps. You're going to take that iMac and reboot it in target disk mode, as long as you can overwrite the hard drive. So make sure there's nothing on that iMac that you want anymore.
No, I'm backing all that up.
Okay.
And then
So you reboot holding down the T key. That puts it in target disk mode. And now you connect the two. If you've got FireWire on both machines, that's the best way. If you don't, you can use Ethernet, just an Ethernet cable to do this. It's just a little slower. Then you use Super Duper to image the laptop onto the target disk, onto the iMac. Now,
okay, is that laid out pretty clearly on their...
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward. The other way to do it, and which would be safer, is to get an external drive. That's
okay. I have a 250, but I'm going to probably go buy at least a 1 terabyte.
Yeah, if you it's a nice thing to have. If you plug that external drive into the Snow Leopard version, run Super Duper on the Snow Leopard to make a duplicate of that laptop onto the external drive. Then you can plug the external drive into the iMac and reboot and hold down the Option key and say boot up from the external drive. This is why I'd recommend that. If there's a problem, like it won't work, you'll know and you can just reboot and you're back to the old for Tiger.
Okay.
You haven't erased the external drive. And if that works, then you can, you know, copy the image over onto the internal drive if you want to do that.
Did you see any reason why it wouldn't work? I mean, even though the iMac is an 06, it's still a Core 2 Duo, and it's got 2 gigs of RAM.
Work.
I mean, yeah.
It should work.
Okay.
It's in general, the best thing to do would be to get a Snow Leopard disk and just format the drive and install it clean.
Right.
You might have drivers on the laptop that aren't compatible with the iMac, that kind of thing. That would be the best way to do it. Do you not have a Snow Leopard disk?
Well, you know, actually, we ordered one, but I'm kind of a dork in that I think you have to have Leopard on it technically to do
it. No. It doesn't check.
Well, it doesn't check it, but it asks you, doesn't it say you have to have it?
Yeah, but ignore that. Format the drive and ignore that. And format the drive and put it on the iMac. That's the best way to do it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
How can I tell?
You just know.
Okie dokie.
Okay.
Everything's okay.
Okay.
Okie dokie.
Okay.
I'm okay if you're okay.
Siri's great when she works. In fact, really, the real problem with Siri is she's so great when she works that when she doesn't work, which seems to be about, you know, one time in 10 or one time in 5, it's frustrating. And I've gotten so used to now, and this is because I got the new iPad and I started doing email on it, and it was so easy instead of typing just to press the dictation button and dictate the email. You have to speak fairly clearly and enunciate words. And when you get to ambiguous words, sometimes she makes a mistake. But she does a pretty good job, period. And you kind of get used to talking like this, period. And once you do, I'm not kidding. I've done so much email that way now that when I sat down and started trying to do email with the keyboard on my computer, it was like, oh, this is hard. Typing's hard. I've used Drag and Dictate and the other solutions before. And my opinion was always, you know, it's 90% accurate, but that means every 10th letter, every 10th word, you have to fix it. And that just slows you down. So I'm not sure I'd want to write a book that way, but for quick emails, it turns out that's a pretty good way to do it, especially if you train yourself to say it, you know, clearly and in a way that Siri can understand. The real frustration, though, is, you know, you're doing something, you say a whole paragraph, and then Siri just doesn't do anything. She stops working. The server's busy or whatever. Man, that makes me nuts. Maybe I should go back and try Drag and Dictate again. Let's go to Delaware next. David is on the line. Hi, David. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
What can I do for you?
Well, one of my fine grandsons came up with a brilliant idea for a game for an app, mobile app.
Uh-huh.
And it lends itself very well to advertising for the big box stores and big stores and distribution transportation companies. And I have looked high and low for a app developer, and when I Google it, naturally I get a million of them. And I really don't know where to start. I thought you may be able to help.
Well, I think I'm going to give you a warning. It's easier to come up with an idea than to make it happen. Especially if you're not a programmer, because you're going to be a little bit at the mercy of somebody you hire. There are a few places you can go to hire coders, however, and I'm going to give you a couple of them. There's one I've recommended before called elance.com. It's like freelance, but without the F-R-E, E-L-A-N-C-E .com. Lots of programmers there. You can hire them there. Not a bad place to go. There are also other well-known places where coders hang out that you can go to hire them. It's just the problem is, I don't know, there's a lot more to getting a successful app than coming up with an idea and hiring a programmer. It's just, there's... you know, it's the same question I get all the time. I invented something and I want to make $1 million. Okay, but it's going to cost you $150,000 to find out if it's a success or not. Not quite so expensive to do apps. Not quite so bad. And there are certainly a lot of kids, a lot of them just getting out of college, who know how to do this. Stack Overflow is very popular with programmers. A little harder to use for regular people, but this is where a lot of good programmers just hang out. It's a question and answer site for programmers. It's really great. I love it. And you can also find programmers here to hire. But I got to say that having the idea and hiring the programmer is the least of your worries. Actually, getting the idea is the least of your worries. Hiring a programmer is going to be challenging. And then making it work and getting it out there and having it marketed and Having a great idea for an app is not such a hard thing to do. I have a lot of great ideas every day before breakfast. There's quite a distance between that and having a success. Big Jim in Dayton, Ohio. Hey, Big Jim. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. Yeah, it's amazing what happens to those app ideas right before breakfast and then after you eat them. They're all gone.
You caught my drift.
Well, you know, I mean, after you have your coffee, it's like,
forget that idea. We do this. We put a pad next to the bed, and in the middle of the night, you have a dream, you think of something, you write it down, and the next morning you go, what does this say?
The best one was my wife, when she was in college, used to do that with a couple of her term papers and woke up one morning and she's like, why did I draw stick figures?
It seemed like such a good idea at 3 in the morning.
It seemed like a great idea at the time. Okay, so here's my question, and maybe Chatroom can help. I am a mid-manager. I do a little bit of C++ programming, but I'm not strong. My foo isn't that strong. I'm looking for a good source or a way to study SQLPL. I really need to learn how to do it well. I've got a couple of people who have given me some, hey, watch this video and that kind of thing, but I need a really strong source to be able to learn it.
Oh, man. SQL is, of course, the structured query language that's used for databases, Microsoft SQL, but also the open source MySQL. So learning that language is actually very, very valuable. It's a procedural language for SQL. I don't, off the top of my head, know where to learn, but I can tell you where I would check first is iTunes U, believe it or not. Because this is a great resource. Many universities now are putting their courseware online. MIT has put every course it has online. And I would guess that MIT has an SQLPL class. And if you're a proficient programmer, you probably could just march right in the door and start studying it. And you would get a college level, an MIT level education in this. So YouTube has them. OpenCourseWare has it. iTunes U has a lot of universities doing this now. I'm excited about it because it means you can, Stanford has some really great programming classes. You don't need to be a Stanford student to take a Stanford programming class. That's awesome.
Yeah, I've used the MIT OCW, and that's just freaking amazing.
Isn't that great?
Some of the stuff that they've got on there.
Have you checked it for SQL?
I have not. Actually, I did it a while ago when they launched a program that in the field that I'm in, and then I kind of got thrusted into the new position with, hey, we need you to do this in programming. I'm like, okay, sure.
Right. The problem is that SQL is pretty high-end. And so learning SQLPL is not, there's lots of I'm looking at lynda.com, for instance, LYNDA, where they have a lot of classes and all sorts of stuff. And they have SQL Server Essential Training. They have PostgreSQL with PHP Essential Training, MySQL Essential Training. But that's not the same thing as learning SQLPL. And I don't see a specific class for that. So I think you're going to a more high-end resource than lynda.com. W3 Schools has some classes in SQL. I don't know if it's going to be what you need because you're really looking for MySQL, but Oracle. You're looking for Oracle. I would check and see if Oracle has some classes, actually.
Okay.
Arkman looked in the chat room and looked and he said, well, there are classes in SQLPL, but they're in German. So here's the...
Mein Deutsch ist not...
Learn German first, and then, Big Jim, no problem. No problem. Once you learn German, easy.
Thanks, Leo.
Thanks, Jim. Great to talk to you. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More of your calls to come. Stay right here. Last half hour of our show this weekend. Let's go to Kuwan in Wisconsin. He's our next caller. Hi, Kuwan. Hey, Kuwan, Leo here. What can I do for you?
I got two questions for you. How you doing?
I'm good. That's one. I'll give you two more. It's okay. The first one's free.
I want to know, Microsoft Essential is a pretty good antivirus that's free. What's the best one, paid or unpaid?
Yeah, I think for free, Microsoft Security Essentials is very good. And if you're too cheap to buy one, one will be provided for you by Microsoft and Microsoft.com/SecurityEssentials. if you want to buy a commercial product, and I think you do get a better product if you spend a little money, you know our advertiser is Nod 32 from ESET, and I absolutely stand behind them. It's an excellent product, very fast, very effective. So that'd be my best bet. Now, they do, and I'll be honest, they do make a full security suite, and I don't generally recommend that. I think that's too heavyweight for most people. Just get the antivirus. Don't tell them I told you this, but just get the antivirus. That's all you really need. Microsoft provides a decent firewall on Windows. That's all you need. If you use a router, you've got a heavy-duty hardware firewall. That'll protect you.
Okay, okay. And the second question, I have a WRT54G router.
Excellent router. Yeah.
I want to know, for these in bandwidths that's out now, I want something with a little more range. What's a good one?
Well, one of the reasons I say the WRT54G is an excellent router, because it's the most hackable router in the business. Okay. You can put Tomato or DDWRT. Those are great firmware programs. I would keep that router and put that firmware on it just to have it, because it's great. But if you want a more up-to-date router, I wouldn't go with Linksys. I'm not a big fan of the Cisco Linksys products. Mm-hmm. I think the best router, consumer router out there is probably the Apple AirPort Extreme. It's expensive, though, and it's not really very good for Windows. So if you're a Windows user and you don't want to spend the $175 that Apple charges, I think D-Link or Netgear both make excellent products.
Which one do you use?
D-Link.
Besides, you use D-Link?
I use D-Link, yeah.
Serial number? Or
You want Wi-Fi?
Yeah.
And you want? Do you need five? You need both bands. You need 2.4 and 5 gigahertz.
I recommend that, because I have guests come over once
it's nice.
In a while.
Yeah, it's nice. I use any of the Game Fuel routers from D-Link, other Game Lounge routers. I'm not sure what the current one is, but I think they're quite good. I've been very happy with them. Maybe the 4300. That's I think the one I'm using. Really like them a lot.
Oh, man, thank you.
You're welcome, Kwan. Thank you for calling. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take bye-bye. Care. All righty, bye-bye. Let's move on here. Next call is Ken in Chula Vista, California. Hi, Ken. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello, Leo. Great show. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Here's my situation. I've got an old XP system running on a Sony hardware. And I've got some exploits. I ran I have ESET antivirus, but I ran the Microsoft security scanner, and I found two exploits. One's a Java, and the other one's looks like it's a Windows. It says Win32. It's a PDF exploit, and it only removed the Win32 exploit partially, and it didn't touch the Java exploit. So I'm sure you're going to tell me that I have to format.
No, not necessarily. So the reason it's possible for Microsoft's malware detector to find it and ESET not to find it if it hasn't actually happened. So you may have those as attachments in your email, for instance, that didn't get executed, because you know better than executing programs that come in your email.
Oh, yeah.
So Microsoft might find those, and ESET might not, or vice versa. So I think if ESET says you're clean, the chances are you are clean.
Oh, I see.
I wouldn't worry about it. I think it's either a false positive or there's a file, a PDF, for instance, that was attached to email. And if you were to run that PDF with an offending copy of Adobe Acrobat Reader, an unupdated copy, then it would infect you. I think that's probably it's something like that.
Oh, okay. So you think it's a false positive. Okay.
I think it probably is. You were running the malware removal tool. Is that what you were finding?
Well, I run all three. I run MRT. I do this like probably seven times a week. I run MRT, Microsoft Security Scanner, and, of course, ESET.
Yeah.
I do a custom...
So the other thing that can happen if you have multiple antiviruses, and by the way, you don't really have a choice because MRT is automatically installed by Microsoft,
exactly.
Is they can sometimes think that the signature file for the other antivirus is a virus.
Oh.
So it could also be, and that's why all the antiviruses say only run one, is because they can. That could be that that's what's happening as well. I've never seen ESET come up with a clean report if there's something there.
Well, I was relying on them very heavily.
Yeah, it seems highly unlikely. It seems much more likely that the MRT is finding a false positive, maybe related to ESET.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. If you want to get a third opinion, you could go to an online antivirus like antivirus.com. That's the Trend Micro antivirus. Uh-huh. Run it, get another opinion.
Okay.
And the online antivirus scanners aren't as effective, but at least they'll give you another opinion. I would guess that it's a false positive. I have never heard of. In fact, according to the Virus Bulletin, which rates these viruses, ESET hasn't missed a virus in a long, like more than a decade. So I think it's more likely a false positive. Jim in Northridge, California, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Jim.
Hi. What a pleasure getting through to you.
Thank you, sir. It's not easy, I know.
Listen, I purchased about 2 months ago a computer software program called Read Iris. And what it's supposed to do, you probably know, it's supposed to be able to, after you scan the document to your desktop or into your computer, you're supposed to be able to remove a line if you want to and read. In other words, you're supposed to be able to edit it.
Yeah, it's what we call OCR software. It's optical character recognition. It takes a picture of a page, which you can't edit, obviously, because it's just a picture, and turns it into text. With varying levels of success.
Uh-oh. Well, I would think that's what this thing is supposed to do.
It's pretty good. It depends on how tiny the font is, how irregular it is, how good a quality printout it is. But Read Iris is it's the best. It's one of the best ones out there. It should do a good job. Is it not working?
Yeah, I can't. Scanned my document and brought it onto my desktop, and then I enter Read Iris, the program.
Yeah,
and I do what it says, and I mean I try to do what it says.
Try scanning from within Read Iris. It should have the ability to scan built into it. What kind of scanner do you have?
It's a HP.
Yeah, so it came with Read Iris.
No.
Oh,
you mean the printer? The printer that I have is an HP.
No, the scanner.
Well, this thing is an all-in-one.
I see, yeah. HP, I thought it came with Read Iris. If it doesn't, though, you should be able to run Read Iris and do the scanning from within. That might help it work.
All right, and Nod 32 as well.
I'm going to cry. Rose and Jack and
my dreams.
He froze. She's a thrill of diamond overboard.
I feel you.
That's terrible.
That is how I know you.
100th anniversary of Celine Dion singing that song. No, of this. I shouldn't make fun. I shouldn't mock. It was the greatest maritime tragedy of all, the sinking of the Titanic. Really interesting. Been a lot of great stuff on National Geographic Channel. And, of course, the 3D version of the movie, which yesterday our home theater guy, Scott Wilkinson, said was pretty good, surprisingly good. He hated the 3D version of Star Wars, but he said that, no, they did a pretty good job with the Titanic. I'll pass. I actually liked that movie, but I'm a Titanic buff. I read every book when I was a kid. I was fascinated by it. Well, we have one more segment of the show before the show winds up. I invite you to visit our website if you have any questions or you missed something, you want to know more information about things we talked about. It's all there at techguylabs.com. Enjoy its stylish design because it's about done. We've got the new site we'll be launching in about a month, maybe 6 weeks. We expect certainly by June 1st to have the new site, the new Tech Guy Labs up, and I'll have lots of neat features in there. And we will be inviting many of you to join the Team Tech Guy to help us answer questions all week long. I'll explain that. There'll be some nice prizes. TechGuyLabs.com. You'll also find links to not only the show notes, but our chat room. The chat room goes all the time. 24/7. There's always somebody in there. Our other shows, I do a bunch of shows. I have a whole podcast network devoted to technology coverage called TWIT, T-W-I-T. If you Google TWIT, you'll find it pretty quick. Or go to TWIT.TV. We also have audio and video from previous shows and all of that. TechGuyLabs.com. Vern is in Palm Desert, California, our next caller. Hi, Vern.
Good afternoon, Leo. Help, help.
Oh, no. What's wrong?
Oh, well, you know, like a lot of people, I made the move over to iCloud from Mobile Me. And my problem is I have an Android phone. And so I went ahead and I went through the steps that they said to do on iCloud, setting it up in IMAP, and it just refuses to authenticate my login.
Huh. Yeah, I always, in my Android phones, I use, of course, Google Calendar, Google Contacts. I just prefer to do it that way. And the nice thing is the Apple will sync with those. So the cloud I prefer to use is actually the Google Cloud. And then that way Android has no trouble with it. And frankly, the iPhone has no trouble with it. I'm not surprised to hear that Android has trouble with Apple's solution. I mean, it's not in Apple's interest, is it?
No, it's not in their interest. And, you know, that has been the email that I've used for years. It's my primary email on the go. And
it It's dot, you mean it's at me.com is the email you want to use?
Yes.
Ah, I see the problem. I see the difficulty here.
So do I.
Yeah. So let me ask the chat room. Is anybody using an Android phone with Mobile Me or iCloud and getting that mail? It's supposed to be IMAP, right?
Yeah, it's set up as an IMAP protocol. And I went
That's a standard. It should work.
Yeah, it refuses to authenticate my login.
Yeah. All right, here is an article from Santosh. How to configure iCloud Mail on Android and other devices. It's from santosh.wordpress.com. Yeah. And you followed his instructions.
I saw the exact same.
Yeah?
Yes, I did. I followed the instructions.
And it didn't work.
P01 to P07 prefix before IMAP.
Yeah. Yeah. Because that you need to know the exact name of the server. And you're using TLS, and you're using the right port and all of that?
Well, I can't even get past the SSL screen, you know, at login. And if I can't get past the first screen...
Right, how are you going to fill in the rest of it?
TLS. Yep.
Hmm. It says, try changing your password on iCloud if the settings aren't working. For some servers, this has solved the problem. Maybe there's an incompatibility between some of the email passwords that iCloud allows and the standard. Let me check also our chat room is so helpful in this kind of stuff. And Arkman has a link to an Apple. Yeah, this is what I would use. Instead of the P07 and all of that, Apple has a knowledge base article. The number is HT4864. Mail server information. In this case, they say the server name is simply imap.mail.me.com. Maybe maybe if we use that instead of that funky one that Santosh recommended.
Well, I did the imap.mail.me.com.
Didn't work either.
And
huh?
I guess I'll go ahead and try changing the password and see if that gets me authenticated.
And then worst case, you know, you can always have Gmail pick up your mail, set up a dummy Gmail account and use that. Gmail will allow you to use @me.com as your return address. It will not be apparent that you are using Gmail.
Okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And are you using this on Wi-Fi? Have you tried it on both Wi-Fi and 3G?
I've tried it on both.
All right. And you're not, let's see. You're using port 993 because it does require that. Maybe it's just a password. Try changing it.
Okay.
I know how you feel. I have all sorts of weird little things going on with iCloud. It's extremely frustrating. And my suspicion is that Apple just isn't very good at the cloud. That's why I prefer to use Google. Google is a cloud company. Apple's a hardware company. And MobileMe was a horrendous failure, and I think that they have not necessarily made good with iCloud. I think that they are not great. Now, Kyle is saying in our chat room that he changed the password and it fixed it. So maybe that's the solution. Maybe that's all you need to do. If I can. Jose, Leo Laporte, the tech guy from Modesto, California. Is it Clonezilla or Godzilla you want to use?
Clone.
Yes. Hello. Okay. Whew. Clonezilla is great. Don't use Godzilla. It's Japanese monsters generally are not best for drive imaging. However, Clonezilla, which is an open source free program for drive imaging, is very good. And a lot of people I know use it and like it.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, my question is that, well, first of all, I've been using it to clone my hard drive
to external
hard drive via USB docking station, everything.
Okay.
I just wanted to know if it's easy and simple to swipe it after any kind of situation, like if my internal hard drive dies.
Oh, yeah, that's what you use it for. Get a new hard drive, restore, and you're good to go. Thanks for the call, Zay. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.